From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For Siddhartha Mukherjee, there were two parts of his life that made him interested in genes. There was the personal part. His family has a history of mental illness. And then there's his scientific work as a cancer biologist. Cancer, he says in his new book, is the ultimate perversion of genetics. Mukherjee describes his new book as the story of the birth, growth, and future of one of the most powerful and dangerous ideas in the history of science, the gene. The more we understand and the more we're able to manipulate the human genetic code, the more questions we have. What does it mean for identity and vulnerability and human variation? Who are the masters of this technology? Who are the victims? Siddhartha Mukherjee is joining us today. You can see why he calls his book An Intimate History. Join us after the news.
Stay connected with KUER throughout the day on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. We'll bring you stories from our local news team along with program updates and features from NPR, BBC, and other network providers. Get the scoop on upcoming events, meet your favorite public radio personalities, and find out what's happening at the station behind the scenes by following KUER on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Siddhartha Mukherjee has said when he turned in his manuscript for his acclaimed book, The Emperor of All Maladies, 6 years ago, he was physically exhausted. And you can see why. It was an epic story of an epic subject. And Mukherjee says he worried the project may have sapped all the stories from him, that as a writer, he had nothing left to tell. But here it is, 2016, and he's back with another impressive volume. Turns out he had plenty of stories left. Like The Emperor of All Maladies, this book is also a biography, a history. He describes it as the story of the birth, growth, and future of the gene. And the history part is really fascinating. The future part is kind of scary because we've come to a point where we can read the human genome. We can even write human genomes in a way that Mukherjee explains was inconceivable just 2 or 3 or 4 years ago. It's not a story, he says, of our distant future. It's already embedded in our present. Today in the program, Siddhartha Mukherjee is joining us. His new book is called The Gene, An Intimate History. Siddhartha Mukherjee is an assistant professor of medicine at Columbia University and a cancer physician and researcher. He's published articles in Nature, in the New England Journal of Medicine, the New York Times, and Cell. He's joining us today from NPR member station, KUOW in Seattle, where he's now on book tour. And Siddhartha Mukherjee, welcome back. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I mentioned right there in the introduction that when you finished The Emperor of All Maladies a few years ago, you wondered whether you'd be able to write another book, let alone about such a massive subject as the gene. What led you forward? What made you embark on such a large project so soon after that book?
It's not been soon. It's been 6 years. But, the project is a six-year project because it covers a lot of territory. But the impetus for it came from my own history, from my own story. Yeah. The story of illness in my family, mental illness, schizophrenia and bipolar disease, is a story that I grew up with. It was very much part of my growing up years. It was something we didn't talk about for a while because my parents had elevated denial to a museum grade art. But when that illness crossed one generation and became manifest in the second generation, the same lineage, in my same father's lineage, and I went to visit my cousin who has schizophrenia in Calcutta, it couldn't be denied anymore. And there was a very pivotal conversation that I had with my father, which I record in the book, in which, we sort of started facing the question head on. What is heredity? What is it? Why do we, how does it move across generations? And how do we understand it? What shadow would it cast on our future? That story became the central sort of story driving the gene and my exploration. And that's how I came to it. And once I had gotten there, I sort of was burning with curiosity about how to write about it, how to write this enormous history which spans, you know, all this and yet becomes so current today, these questions that are burning up today. You know, what is identity? What is race? Mm-hmm. What does it mean? What does sexual identity mean? What does gender mean today? All of this stuff became sort of started coming at me once I'd started launched. It was like a box I had opened.
You know, it's interesting. Your father, you went to see your cousin, as you say, who was confined to this institution for the mentally ill. And your father didn't, I'm not sure if he does anymore, but at the time you said he didn't really accept the diagnosis of your cousin Moni of schizophrenia. Because, as you put it, he worried that some kernel of the illness may be buried like toxic waste in himself. Does that explain that sort of unease that he and your grandmother felt about all of this?
Absolutely, and there was a great unease about it, and it remained very uneasy. They couldn't believe that this could have crossed a generation and become manifest again. So that's why they came back into the idea over and over again that there must be something wrong with ourselves, with our essence. And it was really, my father had a very hard time. He still has a very hard time understanding it.
There was this moment when your father was worried that you too might be afflicted with mental illness, because you went through this kind of period of defiance, and he was, I guess it would be fair to say, he was terrified.
Yeah, it was, you know, for me, it was a kind of, in retrospect, it was a kind of adolescent flirtation with defiance. Mm-hmm. But my father, as virtually every adolescent has, but that's what's interesting about genes, mm-hmm. is that, you know, you don't know whether this is a transient thing or whether it's going to be permanent, whether it's heritable, whether it's going to go away. Is it part of you? Is it not part of you? I mean, these were questions that were really burning up in my father's mind.
Before I move away from your family, I do want to ask about this because it comes up a few times in the book. Your father and your grandmother believe that that this is not buried in your genes, but the mental illness of his brothers and of your cousin is a reaction to partition of the British Indian Empire in 1947. Would you say
about that? Yeah, partition was an incredibly important moment in their lives, less so in mine, but very important to my grandmother, who came as a refugee, really, across the border during partition. Her land was ripped into two and shredded, really. Mm-hmm. It was kind of vivisection of history was a very important touchstone. But it was also a reminder to me that, you know, they had also gotten something right about it, that there was a kind of that genes may not be acting alone, that there could be a trigger for my uncles, at least, who had experienced that in tremendous upheaval, and that in the context of that upheaval, you know, they had brought out something in them that they couldn't fully understand, that their mental illness was a combination, perhaps, of genetic determinants and environmental changes, you know, terrifying trauma and upheaval in their case.
Let me ask you about some of the questions that start to come to you about 6 or 7 years ago when you're thinking about this. You mentioned walking around the streets of New York, being on the subway and reading these studies. And this volley of new questions, you put it, started to come to you. What are the questions you're thinking about at the time as you start thinking about all of this?
I mean, the questions are the questions that reverberate through the whole book. How much of each of us, you and me, is the product of genes, and how much of it is not? If we were to find genes and we could read our futures by looking at those genes, even in probabilities, you know, I'm not saying that you'd have 100% chance of, you know, having schizophrenia, etc. Would it change who we imagined ourselves to be? How would it change it? And you know, perhaps most importantly, there are new technologies that allow us to now intervene on the human genome. We can change the human genome in a way we couldn't do 5 years ago or 10 years ago. What would that mean? Mm-hmm. What would that mean for ourselves? Who would be the masters? Who would be the victims of this technology? How would we perceive ourselves in the future? How, again, the questions like, who are we? Mm-hmm. What is the nature of identity? How much of it is encoded? How much of it is acquired? So these kinds of questions, and the book sort of at that point of time sort of began to speak. I mean, I was in a subway, but it just began to speed up like a train. Mm. And I could see sort of in that moment the book was being, I could see the book being born.
Yeah. at the center of the story, or one of the centers anyway, is this idea that we can in some way perfect humankind, that we can, you know, decipher the manual of instructions of the way we work as human beings and perfect humankind, which has led to a lot of disastrous stories, which we'll get to as we go along. But this idea that we can perfect humankind, I guess it's human nature for us to be thinking about that, I suppose.
It is absolutely human nature to be thinking about that. It comes up over and over again. I hope we'll spend some time talking about how it can be perverted or in the macabre forms it can take. I'm thinking specifically about eugenics.
Right.
The book has a story of eugenics, in fact, a surprising story. I didn't fully understand it myself until I read it, about how Americans, eugenics may not have been brought to its sort of macabre Nazi perfection here, but Americans were colluded in bringing this idea and nurtured and fed it in the 1920s.
In the book, you describe the ideas of the gene as being powerful but also dangerous. Before we dig into all of this, what do you mean by dangerous? Because that's an interesting word.
I use it very carefully in the book, and in fact, virtually all the reviewers picked up that idea, and I'm glad you brought it up. Dangerous means that we don't know how we're going to use it properly. It's dangerous because it's very powerful. They're linked. They're like two strands of DNA. They're linked to each other in this way that's very majestic and also very frightening. And that is that the idea is that, you know, what if you could control your destiny? Or what if you could partially control the destiny of someone else through genetics? Would you use that technology? And as we ease more and more towards that idea, it becomes very dangerous. I'm reminded that in the past, when we've tried to use genetic technologies at a wide societal level, we've ended up in places or we've ended up with stories like the Nazi eugenic efforts.
Yeah. It's interesting you mentioned that the gene, there are these three powerful ideas that emerge in the 20th century, really start to develop. It's the idea of the bite, the idea of the atom, the idea of the gene. And the thing they have in common, you point out, is their essential elements. They're, in other words, they're building blocks of this larger whole. What you say in the book gives us this idea of potency and force. Why is the idea of a building block, why are those so powerful for us in the 21st century, do you think?
When I thought back about what science is doing in this last century, I thought that, you know, there's an interesting commonality between these three ideas, the atom, the bite, and the gene. In all three cases, we have the capacity to get to the material essence of something, you know. The atom, the material essence of matter, the bite, the material essence of, you know, the algorithm, as it were. It really should be the bit, but
nice.
And the gene, the material essence of heredity and biological information. And in all three cases, what's interesting when you think about all three cases, atom, bite, and gene, is that they open up. Once you get because these things, matter and heredity, are organized in hierarchies. If you get to the center of it, you can control it very powerfully. And that's what makes these very powerful ideas. If you can understand the structural anatomy of genetics, you can figure out how to manipulate human genes and therefore manipulate human destiny to some extent. And similarly, if you can understand the structural anatomy, as it were, of matter by the atom, you can control matter. You can explode it. You can make a bomb, or you can make gold. So it seemed to me that these are connected ideas because you're getting to the essence of something. And once you get to the essence of something, you can control it.
The arc of the book is historical. In some ways, it's very much a similar approach to the Emperor of All Maladies. Why is the framework of history important for you in telling these stories?
Framework of history is important because it reveals a kind of progression of knowledge, and it's very clarifying. We understand concepts as they build on concepts. We learn the discoveries as they happen, and that's very important because it gives us all the vocabulary that's important to build up. But what's interesting about this book, which is not true for Emperor, is that towards the end, as I sort of delved into the book, I began to realize that the historical arc had to be broken because there was so much going on in the present.
Right.
Questions of what it means to have, you know, what does race mean? Well, genes can tell us a lot about race. What does, you know, what does identity mean? What does gender identity mean? Genes can tell us richly about these ideas. So much of the arc of the book, the latter arc of the book, becomes thematic. Right. And I thought that that interplay was very helpful to me. You acquire the vocabulary in the first half of the book. You understand why those discoveries happened, why they were important, and what happened to them. And then as you move forward, you can begin to understand how to apply them to the world at large and why we need to apply them, because otherwise this conversation can get uprooted and get misplaced. So I really wanted to arm ourselves with vocabulary, and that history does that. And once you have it, you can have a really thoughtful conversation through the book about our future.
We'll talk about the history part of this story when we get back from a break. Siddhartha Mukherjee is joining us. His new book is The Gene, An Intimate History. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer and oncologist, researcher Siddhartha Mukherjee is back with us. You remember his book, The Emperor of All Maladies. It was a history of cancer, won the Pulitzer Prize, his latest, also an epic subject, and it's also a personal story in many ways for him. It's about the story of the gene, the history in our understanding of how genes work and behave, also about the quest to unravel the human genome. It's called The Gene, An Intimate History. Siddhartha Mukherjee is joining us from a studio in Seattle. So let's talk a little bit about, you say the question of likeness has preoccupied philosophers and scientists for hundreds and hundreds of years. Why, first of all, that idea of likeness? Why is that something that has been so fascinating for people?
The question of likeness has been one of our fundamental questions. We've thought about it over and over again for years and years and years. And over and over again, we've thought about how and why we resemble our parents, and how and why we don't resemble our parents.
Right.
You know, we both these things are one of the most, some of the most ancient things we've ever thought about. And why that, how that resemblance or difference turns out to have effects on the rest of our lives. I mean, you know, what is destiny, and how is destiny related to how we transmit likeness to each other? You know, a parent with one illness transmits that illness to their daughter or son. Is that likeness, and why did that get transferred? I mean, these are questions that have been perennially present in human history.
Pythagoras had one of the earliest theories. It's kind of strange when you think about it now, but talk a little bit about that. It even appears in an Aeschylus play.
And in a surprising Aeschylus play because,
yeah.
You know, Pythagoras thought that basically, he thought that the male contributed all the information, and the female was just kind of an intravenous bag dripping nutrients into the fetus. You know, the male contained all the information. The female took that information and sort of blew it up like a blow up doll and made a human being. And there's a surprising moment in a play, in which. In which one of the characters is accused of murdering his mother. And matricide, as you know, is considered a very large sin. This was a big problem. And the defense says, well, the mother is just a carrier of the child. You know, she just essentially provides nutrients for the child. The real news or the real information comes from the father, and this is used to say that, you know, killing your mother is no different from having a battle, you know, a battle with a stranger. And in fact, the word is used, a stranger to a stranger, is the word that's used. You know, a child to his mother is a stranger to a stranger. I couldn't think of myself a stranger way of thinking about human heredity, but that was a theory that was certainly popular at a certain time.
One idea had it that sperm already already contained a mini fetus that was like this fully formed. It just had to kind of get bigger, I guess.
And that was called A Homunculus. There's a fabulous picture of it from 1600s in the book. People who read might want to look at that picture because it's a reminder of how complicated these theories could get. One interesting feature of that is, of course, that if your sperm contains a little mini human, you just add water and blow it up like a little baby preformed little doll, then of course that human being has to have his or her own children inside, and so forth ad infinitum. So basically, it has to be a homunculus within a homunculus, and another one within the homunculus, and forever, stretching forever for all the future of human beings. You would have to carry all the future human beings inside you, wrapped up like little dolls,
right,
waiting to be unfurled. So obviously, it was an idea that was quite absurd if you pushed it to a point, but many people believed it.
It's amazing how Aristotle doesn't quite get it right, but he gets close at least to the concept, I suppose.
Well, Aristotle, people think of Aristotle as the great philosopher. I think of Aristotle as the great biologist first. He figured out some very important things. Among them, most importantly, he figured out that that what was really happening, what was really moving from parents to children was information.
Right.
And that the information was the crucial piece of it. It wasn't as if there was a little blow-up doll that was being blowed up. And in fact, both mother and father contributed information. That was another realization. He figured out that sometimes a child can look like his grandmother or have his grandmother's hair. So there has to be something there. It wasn't just a kind of free-for-all, as it were, of the father producing a child and the mother blowing it up. And that was a crucial realization. He had other mistaken conceptions of what was going on, but he had figured out there was information that was moving in this way.
Saw it as heredity is kind of a flow of information, like a river, you say, of code moving from egg to embryo. So he comes up with this idea of a currency of information, but it's Gregor Mendel, you say, who finds it's the real currency here. Let's talk about Mendel. He's a fascinating story. He's a monk who wants to be a scientist and a teacher. I love the chapters about Mendel, I have to say, because he you really bring him to life. He is kind of disorganized in some ways. Seems like in some ways would have been a terrible teacher. He kept sort of failing. But he's a great gardener, and he's a tender gardener, and this seems to be the key to the insights that he comes to.
Yeah, Mendel is a fascinating character in the book, probably the most important character in the book, because he's a monk, and yet he's a scientist. The Augustinians didn't see much of a dissociation between monks and science. They loved it, actually. And then he fails his exams. He's bumbling around. He's sitting in his abbey. I went to the abbey, spent some time there, actually, in the Czech Republic some years ago. And then he starts breeding. I mean, his great ability is that he's a great farmer. Mm-hmm. And he picks up from other farmers. He starts picking up the idea that you can crossbreed plants, peas in his case. And right. He just focuses kind of monastically on one question, which is how are these, characteristics like the color of a flower moving from one generation to the next? And he performs these experiments. They're very detailed. He makes, mathematical tables and so forth. But essentially what he discovers, and this is what's key about it, is that when hereditary traits move from one organism to the next organism, they're doing so in like units. Mm-hmm. They're not breaking up. They're not blending with each other. There was an ancient conception that, if you had a father with blue eyes and your mother had yellow eyes, then you'd be born with green eyes. It was just a simple wearing blender. Mm-hmm. But Mendel discovers that that's not the case, that there are things that are moving across generations that seem to have this kind of unitary quality to it. And that's what's very crucial.
Patterns he sees. He sees these constancies. He sees these, you describe it in the book, as kind of numerical rhythms in what he was looking at.
Absolutely. And he finds these numerical rhythms that move across generations. Now, what's important to remember is that Mendel doesn't coin the word gene.
Right.
That's a word that is coined years later. He doesn't even know what the gene looks like. All he can tell, just by looking at mathematics and just by looking at his peas, and there's a description of it in his experiments in the book, he can tell that something is moving, some kind of trait is moving, and it's moving in an unbroken manner, in an indivisible manner, between, you know, one generation to the next.
Spends a number of years writing a paper, and then finally, I think it's 1865, he has it all written down and he reads it, and it's kind of a disappointing part of the story in some ways. You'd think it's going to get this remarkable reaction, that it's going to explode the scientific community, but it doesn't.
Well, what author doesn't think their book is going to explode the scientific world?
Right,
or otherwise?
Right.
No, but Mendel had great, you know, he really thought he had stumbled on something important. Mm-hmm. But he really didn't have a venue. He was not a classical or traditional scientist. He was not sitting in the lab. He was a monk in a garden. Mm-hmm. And he sat there and thought and published his paper, you know, lots of detailed tables. And he said at the end of it, and essentially it was ignored. It was ignored not just for 1 year or 2 years. You know, he had founded probably one of the most important things in biology, how we transmit information to our children, but also how cells continue to maintain and that information during our lifetimes. You know, it's the basis for you and me. Mm-hmm. And yet the paper was entirely forgotten. For 35 odd years, it would be basically forgotten.
When does somebody finally realize this monk had it right? He had discovered something significant.
Well, the question kept coming back over the, you know, the next 35 odd years. Yeah. And the question became more and more refined, which is, how is it that information moves through biology? Why is it that, you know, what is the nature of it? What is how are things happening? So this question keeps coming back in various forms. And finally, in the 1900s, people go back to the question and ask again, what's the mechanism behind this? And that's when they discover Mendel's paper again. 35 years later, Mendel's unfortunately died himself. He never got the fame that he deserved.
How does Charles Darwin play into the story? Because this early part of this he's an important player here too. Obviously,
Darwin of course has his own track. He remains basically unaware of Mendel. They're contemporaries, and you know, one of them is in that small monastery in Brno in the Czech Republic. That's Mendel. And Darwin soon becomes one of the most celebrated scientists in the world. And he's in England. Mendel knows about Darwin. Darwin has no idea about Mendel. But what's interesting about Mendel, about Darwin, is that Darwin, of course, founds this monumental theory of evolution. And that's based on the idea that there's natural variation in the world. Mm-hmm. There are, you know, different kinds of shapes and forms that naturally occur, natural variation, and that natural selection then picks out one of those or some of those, and that's how evolution occurs. But what's interesting about Darwin is that Darwin also figures out later in his life that natural variation demands, in order to have natural variation, they should also have these things have to be passed on to the next generation. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you know, if it's just natural variation and it keeps producing more natural variation, and every year, every time there's a selection episode, if you think about it, things will just go backwards and get diluted back to normal. You know, in a way, you could say that all if the finches, mm-hmm. if Darwin's famous finches, if they can't transmit their colors down the road to their offspring, and if all the colors keep blending, then all of them will eventually become like paint. They'll all become gray. And so it's a beautiful idea that Darwin encounters. And Darwin is so brilliant as a human being that he picks up on that idea and he learns of it from someone else. But he picks up and he says, you know, there's got to be a mechanism by which information is conserved or spread from one generation to the next. And so Darwin almost comes to the idea of information, but he doesn't get there completely.
We finally get a name from a Danish botanist. Gives us the name gene. Explain how we get there to this point. If the name really works all that well.
The name comes. People have been by the early 1900s. It's been very clear that there has to be a name for this thing. This thing that's traveling across generations, carrying information. There's got to be a name. And finally, someone says, "Well, what about gene?" Obviously, it's borrowed from generation and it's borrowed from genus and all of these other ideas, you know, to give birth. And it gives birth to a new discipline, quite literally. And that's how we get the name gene.
people may be surprised to read the nature of the genetic code, you say, is actually really simple. There's just one molecule that carries our hereditary information and just one code. Give us a sense of how it is that that's an incredibly simplistic question, but how does it work, the gene?
Well, let me walk through a scenario. So what happens is genes are like a code. They're used to build. That code is decoded in a cell, and it's used to build a messenger. The messenger is like a fax copy of the gene that can circulate in the cell. And then that messenger, the fax copy of the gene, built out of the gene's template, is used to build a protein. And a protein is a molecular machine. It has all these roles. It's a master conductor. And the protein essentially conducts the genome. This is what's fascinating about this idea. It's a beautiful idea. All our genes together, they're used to build products that are then used to control genes. And this circularity, this circle, genes make messages that make proteins that, I shouldn't say make, that are used to build proteins that control genes. This circularity is responsible for then an embryo unfolding and becoming, you and me, a human being.
I want to get to that question we were talking about earlier, the idea of eugenics. Adam Cohen has written a book also about this, the history of eugenics. It's sort of more legal.
It's a wonderful book, actually.
We had him on the program, and so he mentions you also write about Francis Galton, who publishes this provocative book just 1 year after Darwin dies. And he lays out, as you put it, this strategic plan, essentially for the improvement of the human race. Goes back to that idea that we were talking about before. But what I loved is not just Galton's kind of crazy ideas, but the battles that he does with a man by the name of William, is it Bateson or Battison?
Bateson.
He was a great adversary. And Bateson really challenges Galton and these other eugenicist ideas. We'll talk about this part of the story.
Well, Galton was Darwin's cousin, as it turned out.
You're right.
I mean, a strange coincidence to these two great minds born in the same family. Galton was a great statistician, a great mathematician. And he picks up this idea from Darwin that natural selection can select, different forms of animals. And he says, well, why don't we do the same instead of natural selection? Why don't we artificially breed human beings and make the human race better? Why don't we selectively breed the most powerful, the strongest, the most beautiful? Again, these are definitions that he's most interested in, and make and emancipate the human race. And what's interesting, and here's fascinating, that this is not thought of in, and he coins the term eugenics to describe this, eugenics from better genes. But this is not thought about in the early 1900s as some kind of weird, crazy idea. This is thought about as by many progressive intellectuals, many progressive minds, as a reasonable thing to want to do. We should want to change the human race for betterment, and we should want to change it and by selective breeding. And so Galton writes eugenics, and there are many people who support it, many people who are big fans. But William Bateson, who is a geneticist, he has studied Mendel. He's actually one of the people who's responsible. His nickname is Mendel's Bulldog because he becomes a big champion of the idea that genes are being carried, genes are what's carrying information across. Bateson looks at Galton's work and realizes that Galton can unleash a terrifying problem, that if we start controlling genes. This is in the early 1900s. Bateson realizes that if you start controlling genes, you can unleash unbelievable power because you get to you've put your finger on this intense form of biological information.
I'm thinking, and we'll get to the sort of the future of all of this now, but it's different in important ways. But there's also a kind of a similarity in the concerns that Bateson was having and ethicists are having today. Don't you think?
Absolutely. And that's why I put Bateson, there's a very famous quote from Bateson that concludes the chapter on eugenics, which is, he says that there is no doubt that this will unleash an incredible form of power, and that those who control this power will want to control the nature of our destiny and our future. And it's, you know, we come back to that towards the end of the book, in which we ask a question, well, who gets to control this? Who gets to control the destiny of human beings?
Before we leave Bateson, I did want to ask you something else about it. What Bateson brings to the picture is this idea that the flow of biological information, as you put it, is not restricted to heredity. You say in the book that Bateson realized that information is coursing through all of biology. What did he mean by that?
Well, that's a very important idea, and it's an interesting and important point that we need to just kind of clarify and hammer home, which is that genes don't only transmit heredity, they transmit all information.
Yeah.
In other words, you know, genes are revealed. We understand genes better because you can see the similarity between you and your father. So the analogy that I use is that, you know, when you think of heredity simply, you think that, you know, heredity must be transmitting information that makes your father's nose similar to your nose. But what heredity really is trying to solve is, how does a nose get built in the first place? How do we have noses anyway? How do we have hair anyway? How do we look like we look anyway? Why is it that it's not the question of the individual likenesses between you and your parents? It's the fact that out of that same code is built likeness, period. The fact that you look like yourself. That's what Bateson figures out. He figures out that every domain of biology is really an unfolding of information. You know, when a plant moves towards the sunlight, that is using information that all plants have, that they move towards the sunlight. Well, where's that information coming from? It's encoded, and it was encoded when that plant was in its embryonic form. Otherwise, it couldn't have acquired that information. So Bateson makes that incredibly important leap.
You point out genes are not the only lens through which we view our nature and our destiny. But what else is there? I guess this brings up the question of the role of environment in the play of all of this.
Right. So I think I try to be very clear about the idea that genes are not the only thing that are working in our lives to make us who we are.
Yeah.
Genes intersect with environments. They intersect with chance, with triggers. And it's genes plus environment plus chance plus triggers that makes us who we are. That's the ultimate result in who you and I are. So make no mistake that genes are part of that equation, but not the entire equation. But it's also important to remember that they're a very important part of that information or that equation, because if we forget that, we begin to attribute things that are not true.
There's a number of questions. Here's one from Judy in Salt Lake City, who wonders, what is the relationship between our genes and the susceptibility to environmental triggers like air pollution, for example, and cigarettes? Are we coming to understand more about those triggers and about those environmental factors?
Well, we're trying to understand. This is one of the greatest projects that we're trying to understand right now, is how genes intersect with triggers and environmental factors to cause disease. Yeah. And potentially to cause variation. And by variation, I mean how you and I are different from each other, our identities, ourselves. How do these things sort of collide and compete and mix together to form the variations that we observe in human beings? And how is that maintained across generations? It's a massive project, and, you know, individual instances of that have become clear. You know, how is it that, just to give you the example from cancer, how does cigarette smoke cause cancer? Well, cigarette smoke contains carcinogens. These are environmental factors that intersect with your genes. They change the genetic sequence. They change the genetic code. They cause mutations. And those mutations caused a change in the behavior of a cell in your lung to start dividing. That's a classic example of genes plus environment equals that illness. Now, what's interesting about it is that if you didn't have the genetic piece, if you didn't know that it was genes, you would say, well, cigarette smoke causes cancer, but you wouldn't know why. And you wouldn't know why there's an element that some people who smoke don't get cancer. Well, because there's some chance involved in all of this. You know, some people don't get it because of chance reasons. Other genes might be involved. There might be protective genes. So all of a sudden, once you've opened the box of genes, you can look at a disease like cancer in a completely different manner.
Siddhartha Mukherjee is joining us. His new book is The Gene, An Intimate History. We'll take another quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Siddhartha Mukherjee. We're talking about his new book, The Gene, An Intimate History. The expanse of this story, it's impossible to get to all of the details. There's obviously Watson and Crick and Wilkins and Franklin and the three-dimensional structure of DNA and the revolution of DNA being identified as the source of genetic information, the action of a gene. I mean, all of these things that I don't want to speed past, but, you know, there's not a
lot
of time.
Don't. Everyone's going to read about them.
Right. So good, good. Very good. Okay. I'm glad you put it that way. But there are these, and I think you were referring earlier to some of this, three big projects left. Let's talk about some of these that are still ahead, as you say, for human genetics. I think you mentioned
There are many big projects. I'll just highlight a couple of
please,
them.
Please, yes.
So one of them is to functionalize the genome. And by functionalize, I mean, you know, we know the code now for, you know, the master code, as it were. I talk about it. So the code is written in just four alphabets in DNA. It's right. A, C, T, and G. And if the human genome has 3 billion letters, 25, 24, 21,000 genes, that number keeps changing in 3 billion letters. If you were to write that code down in standard script, it would be 66 full sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. So that's what that human genome looks like. And if you were to pick out one of those volumes, it would be totally inscrutable to you. It would read ACT, GCC, CCTC, CCGGG. I'm making it up, but you know, it would look entirely inscrutable. So, and yet, an embryo can take that sequence and make a human being out of that sequence. Clearly. So that's one enormous question. What kind of information is in there? Well, there are genes, but what else is in there? There are sequences that tell the genes when to turn off, when to turn on. There are sequences that we don't know any function of. There are things that regulate genes, things that twist DNA in three-dimensional space and allow genes to, you know, far away from each other on the same piece of DNA to talk to each other in three dimensions. So that's one project, is to figure out what is in that code. The second project is to figure out what does it do?
Yeah.
Once you've identified the elements of the code, what does it do? And the third project, which is probably the most tantalizing, is can we change it?
Right.
What if we went into that encyclopedia and erased one word from that encyclopedia and changed one element that might be the setup for a terrible human disease? How would that work?
You pose a thought experiment in the book. You say, suppose you could sequence the genomes of 100,000 children before anything is known about the future of these children. In essence, creating this fate map. And I wanted to ask you about this because you talk about whether we can decontextualize genes. You say with enough subjects and enough computational power, you say, nearly all of the predictive capability of the genome can, in principle anyway, be determined and computed. That sounds amazing.
But that just is to tell us, you know, if you take a million subjects, probably require a million, and you just ask the question, okay, you have their genome sequence, and then you look forward in time and see, for instance, what diseases they develop. Do they get breast cancer at a higher rate? Who gets breast cancer? And now you go back and ask the question, well, is there some gene that they had in common that they all got breast cancer? Right. Well, if we did this, we would know, you know, some genes we know already. They would have BRCA1.
Right.
They would have BRCA2. But, you know, there are other genes that we don't know about that would pop up. And, of course, there would be things that we couldn't know. We couldn't know whether someone had one kind of experience versus another. You know, we wouldn't know whether if you had a random accident, we wouldn't know whether you sadly fell off a cliff. Well, that's probably not in your genome, but maybe we would know something more profound, which is like what are the kinds of person who is likely to indulge in
risky
behaviors,
yeah.
risky behaviors, yeah. or adventure sports.
Yeah.
That so it really is, you know, I talk about this in the book. The genome is a little bit like, it's like Narcissus reflected. If we go looking for things, we will find things that have genetics. Many things will not at the superficial level. Obviously, we won't be able to predict accidents and vagaries of fate and chance. But we might be able to predict probabilities. We might be able to predict behaviors, predispositions. That's what's fascinating to me about it.
The implications are amazing. You say, imagine a world where a child is conceived and a parent is given then a choice. And we're sort of in some ways headed there, or there in many ways, where you can test the fetus using this genome sequencing in utero. And you can identify even tendencies, like a predilection for obesity, for example, in which case you could sort of map out a diet or a plan for their life. Or even, this was fascinating, you say, what if you could identify the tendency of fear extinction in somebody? Like, you know, you could help prepare someone to cope with or treat PTSD in soldiers. So there's that positive part of this story. But then there's the scary part where you could also strip out some really remarkable parts of what we've come to know as humanity right now.
You know, this is important because this is your story and this is my story. This is not something that's happening in some scientific laboratory somewhere that we should forget about. It's about who you and I are and how we define ourselves. I mean, I used the PTSD example because I picked it up from an article in the New York Times where I didn't propose this, but someone else is proposing, as you know, a psychiatrist was proposing the idea that we should be, you know, maybe we could monitor soldiers for having a propensity towards PTSD and we could, you know, find a way to screen them genetically up front. And find a way to minimize their anguish during war. That sounds like a great idea, but it has flip sides as well. All of a sudden, you've created a label for a person. That's one. Number two is maybe we want soldiers with PTSD, you know, who have at least the capability of reacting to psychic anguish in the battle. I mean, I'm not advocating for any of this. I'm just trying to create thought experiments that we have this conversation in ways that, you know, in ways that are thoughtful and sensible in the future.
You say that, to me, one of the really big questions that you come around to in the book is this idea of what does this do to what we now think of as humanity? Because you say illness might progressively vanish if we're able to manipulate, you know, the human genome, but so might identity. Grief might be diminished, you say, but so might tenderness. Traumas could be erased, but so might history. I mean, there's a lot at stake here in terms of identity, and that doesn't even get us to the question of sexual identity, and because that's a big question now. If there is a so-called gay gene, and it's becoming more complicated, obviously, but can you strip out these things, and what does that mean?
Well, first of all, I don't think that there's something called a gay gene. Right. I think that, but what I do think is the case that I think powerful elements of our sexual identity can be located to genetics. That's a much more fair statement. It's also a much more calming statement, I think, it's a scientifically true statement. So, what I try to do in this book is a massive plea for tolerance. Yeah. I'm not advocating for trauma. I'm not advocating for illness. All I'm trying to say is that let's try to understand what the genome predicts about our future. And let's try to be very, very cautious in using that technology as we move forward because it has the capacity to influence our destiny. Even if it's just predisposition that we find in the genome, that creates a kind of that labels ourselves as a particular kind of human being. And that's very important to be cautious and thoughtful about what happens next. This is a conversation that needs to happen within us. That's why you need the history. You need the history to arm yourself for the future. And if that was the message of the Emperor of All Maladies, here's another message that's exactly the same, that if you don't arm yourself with the vocabulary, if you don't know what genes are, if you don't know what genes can do, if you don't know how they influence, for instance, race, or the identification of race, if you don't know how they influence the identification of sexual behavior and gender identity, you'll make a mistake. We'll be caught in old paradigms, and others will be influencing. So we've got to know the vocabulary. We've got to read the vocabulary and understand it. We have to understand where we are today.
I think the word you use right at the end of the book is this idea of stewardship. We have this stewardship because these technologies that are developing, it seems like exponentially.
Well, last week, you know, I didn't have time to put, I mean, the book was printed several months ago, but yeah. Last week there was a meeting to try to artificially synthesize the human genome as a chemical.
Right.
Now, you can imagine what that means. That means that, you know, you can then, if you can make it as a chemical, then you can change it as a chemical. It becomes a chemical. So, again, we're not there yet, but at least the technologies are being opened, and it's a fascinating area. Who will dictate? Who will figure out what to do with that chemical? You know, will we save repositories of ourselves in little pieces of DNA somewhere, potentially to replicate that chemical in the future? I don't know. Mm. But the idea of stewardship is, I think, a good idea to end with, which is that the human genome is obviously, by definition, the most human of all things we possess.
Yeah.
It is what's responsible for some of the most beautiful, majestic elements of our species. It's also represented, it also must be partly responsible, along with environment and chance, for some of the most reprehensible things that we've done to ourselves. So this is not to say that, you know, everything is genes. That's not the code in this book. The code in this book is there are powerful things in our genomes, that we should look at them carefully, and that we should consider their stewardship in a careful manner as we move forward.
Siddhartha Mukherjee, his book is The Gene, An Intimate History, joined us from a studio in Seattle. Doctor, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you. I'm a big fan of your show.
Thanks very much. Oh, I should mention that there's a new traveling exhibit that explores the science of the human genome. It opened over the weekend at the Natural History Museum. There's a link to that on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.